Now, I've been away for a few weeks. I know you've missed me terribly. I can see you look a lot happier now that I'm back, nice and bright and fresh.
I think our listeners will actually understand that, you know what? We actually got on grand without him, right? And we didn't miss him a bit. But listen, we like him anyway, right?
That's a bit mean. Ratings have plummeted.
We heard the ratings went up while he was missing, right?
Plummeted.
Anyway, listen, we don't like to exclude him, right? Because we do like him, nice guy. A lot to learn. He's only a chap still, right? But a good kid. And we're very happy to help him along his way. We're waiting for Claire. She's at a committee meeting at the moment, and she's a little bit late. Well, we can start without her.
Yeah.
Same as we started without you last week and the week before.
Yeah, no qualms about that.
Today. You should probably start without me next
week. Actually, we'll just lock her out at this stage. We'll do our own episode.
Do it the way possible. Did they ever tell you the story about the hunt? This actually happened in Wexford, right? Now, I'm not sure if everyone knows how the hunt works, right? But the hunt, obviously, goes back many years, right, where you have the gentry riding around on horses with these dogs chasing a fox, right? And there was a time when they could go across anybody's land without their permission, even if it was a field of barley or a field of turnips or whatever it was, right? And they had a right to go wherever they liked because they were the masters, right? But in recent years, even in my younger days, they had to get permission in advance before they plotted out their journey. They had to get permission of different farmers to cross their land, right? On this particular day, and it was in Wexford as well, right? The hunt were out and they were on this land and they came to, there was a big wide gripe with water in it, right? And there was a farm labourer, as they were described at the time, and he was doing a bit of cleaning on a ditch nearby, and the master of the hunt goes up to him and he says, "Would we find bottom in that there box, sir?" And the man says, "Oh, you will, you'll find bottom in that." So, "Thank you, sir, thank you." So, the master of the hunt organises all his troop to start wading through the gripe. Anyway, it was pretty wide, right? So they're about halfway through anyway, and the water and the muck were so deep that the horses were starting to go under the water. So they had no choice. They were afraid to go any further. They decided to do a bit of a Barry Cowan.
I was just thinking, yeah.
Anyway, they did a U-turn. They came back out and the master of the hunt was furious and he goes to the man and says, "Excuse me, sir, I thought you told me we'd find bottom in that there bog." And the man says, "Yeah, well," he says, "well, you're not near it yet."
Our next speaker is Mr. Mick Wallace.
Madness. This is madness. We cannot fix a problem caused by capitalism with more capitalism.
They hurt the people.
I ended up at the end of a gun
on three occasions.
I done well to survive anyway.
Madame Deli will speak.
A union which allows fiscal rules to be broken for arms expenditure,
but not for housing or to put roofs over the heads of people.
This is evidence of police violence. Whether you're an economic migrant or you're an asylum seeker, nobody deserves to be treated like this.
And even having the neck to suggest separating people from their mothers. How dare you?
They don't need us to kick them around the place.
You could say, so what?
This is
the police in riot gear with trunks. I am ashamed to call myself a European.
The recognition of Guaido, unelected gobshite, is an absolute embarrassment.
Now, you did use the word gobshite,
and
so
I would reprimand you over that.
Anyway, welcome back. This is I Foresee Trouble, episode number 23, with Daly and Wallace. You've already heard from Wallace, and Daly's in the room. Say hello.
Hello.
We usually hear too much from her anyway, so it's about time I got, my only chance to get my
word in.
Well, I was
in, the commissioners were in here from the house, so I'm a bit tired.
I mean, people do get on to me, you know, the Daily one does a lot more talking than you, and I said, yeah, well, that's just like...
Well,
I
not
said,
in today's yeah, episode,
I said, I'm probably the more timid, and I said, I'm probably a bit more shy. I said, so that's probably why I don't
talk as
much.
And then he wakes up.
Well, yeah. Show us a bit of shyness at the moment.
Yeah.
Claire, what were you up to there at the committee?
No, we were just saying we had Commissioner Johansson in there, but I was just questioning her on the EU security strategy and asking her about the private sector involvement, because it seems to be really heavy. I was wondering on the lobbying that went behind it and whether she was concerned at the fact that a lot of these security problems that are being identified by the private sector, who are then the ones who benefit from all the hundreds of millions of EU money going in to solve the problems that they've identified. And there doesn't seem to be any sort of other opinion being sought in this. And I think it's particularly interesting, given that we have one of the commissioners, Thierry Breton, the French commissioner, was actually CEO of a company who was on this European observatory body, which is really influential in terms of these contracts, the European Organization of Security. security. And I mean, his company specialised in cyber security and border management. They've got contracts from the EU of hundreds of millions for EU Lisa and other things. And the chair of his company now sits on the European Cyber Security Organisation, which is an organisation of private cyber security stakeholders like Airbus, Thales, Leonardo and all them. And they liaise with the Commission about the EU's cyber security strategy. So what you can see is a nice little, I suppose, circular economy where the people who advise and tell the Parliament what and the Commission what the problems are the companies picking up the spondoolings at the end of the day. So I was able to get her the questions. Didn't hear the answers yet because I had to come here to my boys, but sure, we'll no doubt I'd be waiting a long time to get an answer to that one, I'd imagine.
And what about you, Mick? What's been happening this week?
There's been a lot of stuff going on this week. Both myself and Claire, we had two long sessions on security and defence on Monday. There was 4 hours of it in total, and there was four different items on it. Maybe we'll just kind of touch on each of them. Do you want to have a go at first?
No, far away.
Well, okay. Well, I suppose the first item that I raised was with Graziano is his name. He's actually an Italian fella. He's the head of the EU.
General Graziano.
General. Oh yeah. Well, you love your titles.
I called him General. You called him Claudio. I did, which was a bit informal.
He's called General Claudio Graziano, and Claire, coming from an army background, believes in titles, and she called him General.
I did,
and I said, well, given that he was an Italian, I thought I'd be a little bit informal.
They love the formalities.
And I called him Claudio. Yeah. Right? And Claudio wouldn't agree on a whole lot, right? We probably both like Italy, stops about there. And Claudio, anyway, is the head of the EU Military Committee. And one of the things that he was going on about, so I decided to question him on it, was strategic autonomy. Now, you might say, well, what is strategic autonomy? And strategic autonomy is it sounds something really simple, right? But in actual fact, it isn't. And what it really is the idea that that European countries in the European Union would actually come up with enough money to be able to do what NATO does. Now, NATO, as you know, is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and it was Maria designed after the Second World War to defend Europe, really, right? But in actual fact, it's turned out to be more more aggressive than defensive. And for example, it illegally invaded Yugoslavia in the 90s, and it invaded Libya and done untold damage in 2011, just for two examples. But anyway, this idea of strategic autonomy is where the Americans are kind of saying, Europe, you're not spending enough on defence. And what they really mean is you're not buying enough military stuff from us. Now, and there's people in Europe, especially the Germans and the French and the Brits, who make a lot of these arms as well. And the arms lobby have become very, very powerful in Brussels and Strasbourg, and they do an awful lot of lobbying. But anyway, when we were having our meeting with Graziano this week on Monday, I put it to him that the European Court of Auditors said that the concept of strategic autonomy was just too broad, too vague, and that there was no real agreement on what it should even mean. And an audit last December by the same European Court of Auditors demonstrated that financially it wasn't actually practical to expect the European countries to spend as much on arms to the point where they could actually reach the spending power of NATO and the capability of NATO where they to go to war to defend or to attack or whatever. And that this was just a load of nonsense, and it was just a way of starting a process of spending more on arms, getting member states to spend more. And one of the things that he said in response to my argument was that we've actually got to look at changing the mindset of the Europeans. In other words, we've got them to start thinking that they should be spending more on arms, when in actual fact, it's the opposite we should be doing. But listen, it was a very interesting discussion, and it just didn't. From our point of view, we find this mad militarization of Europe a bad use of resources. It's eating into agricultural spend. It's eating into your environmental projects, and it doesn't make sense.
Well, you made the point, Mick, that we talk about this a lot, and in fairness, we're going to be talking about it an awful lot more. I mean, I'm new on that committee, but I have to say I'm incredibly struck by the amount of time the speakers who come in seem to be interwoven with the industry. They always talk about our industry, the industry, European industry. And it is that who is calling the shots. And I mean, Mick is right. Like, there was a big, and a lot of the members of the committee, a lot of them are Eastern European, and they can't get enough military spend, and they love it. And they'd be bemoaning and see the committee's job almost as defending the defence budget, like, and they're decrying the fact that COVID means resources are being taken away, where myself and Mick are going, well, actually, that's the only good thing about COVID, is there's less money on defence. But when you look at the budget, there actually isn't really, because they're coming up with all sorts of creative ways to get around this. So the European Defence Fund budget might have gone down. But one of the things I was questioning a couple of the speakers at over the sessions on Monday was this European Peace Facility, which sounds nice. It's kind of off the books, about 5 billion, which is not insignificant. And it replaced the old African Peace Facility, you know, the old black babies, we give money and help and support to Africa, like, you know, it's supposed to be longer term investment and all this. The difference between the African Peace Facility and the new named European Peace Facility is that now this money can be used to buy arms. So in actual fact, what they're doing, and the question I asked the speaker who didn't give us an answer, not General Graziano in fairness to him, the civilian who didn't answer the question afterwards, was, do we have a situation where the European Defence Fund is spending EU taxpayers' money to develop armaments? The outcome of that then is purchased with European taxpayers' money through the European Peace Facility and handed over to African countries because they can't afford to buy the weapons themselves. And then they use it to engage in all the mayhem that we've seen, that we discuss later in the meeting, with the breakdown in Africa through North Africa, Libya, Mali, and all the horror on the people in that region. And then some of the people try to get to Europe because their country is such a mess. And it's, surprise, surprise, the same companies that are benefiting from the drones and the borders of keeping them out. And it was very interesting because when we asked, because a lot of the topics on that meeting was about North Africa and the instability in there. And General Graziano had been on the record in an interview in a magazine here earlier in the year as kind of making the point that the NATO destabilisation of Libya and the overthrow of Gaddafi actually wasn't really that helpful. So you'd think he'd join the dots and kind of say Europeans should keep out. But when I asked him what was his attitude to boots on the ground in Libya, in fairness, his answer was a bit scary. You kind of got the impression he was dying for it. Like he was kind of saying, oh, well, that wouldn't be up to us. That's a political question. But we're ready. We'd be capable of going in, which is just mayhem. And it comes back to this same point. The defence industry building all this technology is, they're making it so that it can be used. So they have to have somewhere to use it. And I think that's going to be a common thread in the discussions that we're having in security and defence. I mean, we had two in-camera meetings later on dealing with the situation in Libya and Mali, which I'm not allowed to tell you about because they were kind of secret meetings. Not that there was much to tell, mind you, but just obviously there is no secret about the instability in that region, the coup that was there, probably with European weapons provided. What an absolute sick joke. Meanwhile, as Mick says, all our health service and all our other areas need money.
And just for the record, I was talking about just how much money the member states spent in 2019. The actual figure was 200 billion is what they spent in total, which is phenomenal money to be spending on arms when we're not supposed to be fighting with anybody. On the Malian situation, there was a coup in Mali a couple of months ago, and it was like as if nothing happened. The government in Mali, which were propped up by the French, who raid the place of uranium morning, noon and night, all of a sudden, the people were on the streets. There's a literacy rate of over 70%. Poverty is over 70%. The country's a basket case. It has loads of money, but others, Canadians, French and US companies, are the main beneficiaries of the wealth of the country. So the people were taken to the streets and the military said, well, you know what now? this could be problematic. Let's take over the place. But they did so, and they were actually trained by the US Army, the guys who actually organized the coup and carried it out. And lo and behold, the French mission and the UN mission in Mali hasn't missed a beat, and everything is carrying on as normal. And no one has a problem with the fact there's been a military coup there, because the guys in charge now are not going to upset the apple cart. They're not going to stop Western nations like France, the US, Africa, or Germany and whoever. They're not going to stop them continuing with their exploitation. So that's fine. We don't mind who's in government as long as they're our friends.
And not only the US training them, but I mean, the German defence minister is on the record as saying that a number of them were trained by Germany and France. This has been denied by High Representative Borrell, but I think we can safely take it, given the amount of arms and training that the Europeans have put in, that they too were involved in that. But I mean, we always try and join the dots as well. And, you know, it is poignant that we had that discussion about North Africa at the start of the week, and then we had the horrible scenes of the fires in Lesbos and the Moria camp taking place in the last day or two, where 13,000 men, women and children have been basically imprisoned on the Greek island of Lesbos. As we've said before, a whole number of very valiant Irish aid workers been out there on the front, seeing their work burnt to the ground, medical centres and all the rest, trying to help people. They've been hemmed in the course of COVID. 35 COVID cases has been identified there. Now they're traumatised. The camp has been basically burnt down after, you know, everything they've been through anyway. It's beyond hell. And it really is, you know, we had so many discussions here warning that this was going to happen. And now, sadly, it's happened, and they're talking about now a hurried response to step in. But as we were saying at our committee earlier, they don't need better tents and better. They need permanent living accommodation now, both in Greece, but in other member states as well, because there's no doubt the refugees ending up on the shores of Greece, Italy, Malta or whatever other member states are sitting back. And there have been calls by many parts of Ireland before to take people in this situation and unaccompanied minors and so on. But the Irish government needs to get the finger out now and move in. Those people need to be evacuated off that and brought to safety and permanency in other EU member states.
We had the Foreign Minister for Greece in at the Foreign Affairs Committee this morning, and he was queried on the subject, and his approach wasn't great, and really he was talking about the need to check out to see where did these people come from, can they go back to their own countries. I mean, what they're really saying is while Europe facilitates the destruction of their homes, the destruction of their environment from an environmental point of view, and the destruction of any chance of them earning a living in their own country through neoliberalism, through wars, whatever. But then when they end up on our shores, we don't want to know.
And they're actually actively used by the EU as sort of cannon fodder. They were kept there as a sort of a bargaining chip in the EU migration row. Like, so the Commission has to take responsibility. It is a consequence of the terrible Dublin Agreement. No guessing where that came from. But the Dublin Agreement is largely responsible for creating these hotspots by filtering people and keeping them in their first point of contact. And while they're saying they're going to review that, it's been a long time coming. And sadly, this tragedy was always going to happen. It's only a miracle that nobody has been killed in the fires. But, you know, they don't have any life. So, you know, there's not much comfort in that, to be honest, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And you always make this point as well about going full circle, about following the money as well, from the very beginning of the lobbying to the budgets, military budgets, to the wanting the wars or the fear of or threat of to then the fortress Europe and the borders. So there's always these interests behind that we need to really investigate and look into why these budgets are pushed and why who's doing what. And but that's something you're always pressing.
That's the real face of the EU circular economy. Yeah, that's it. The lobbyists call the shots, set the goals and pick up the spondulics at the end of it.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, Claire, as well about what's going on in Bulgaria. I don't think the Irish media is picking up enough on what's really going on there, but maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. Like, there's a lot of I suppose Poland and Hungary are the bad boys in the EU school. All the liberals here love giving out about Poland and Hungary's treatment of the LGBTIQ community, their interference with the judiciary and stuff, all of which is incredibly unsavoury and unacceptable. But while there's a lot of focus on that and people banging the drum about how outrageous that is, nobody ever talks about Bulgaria in here in the EU, which is a bit weird because they are the EU's poorest country. They had about 9 million of a population. It's down to about 7 million now with the amount of people who've left. And essentially, it's been ruled by, it's a mafia-captured state run by oligarchs and thugs who essentially use the state and EU money for their own personal private gain. There have been untold numbers of scandals, including about member MEPs who've been involved in scandals involving, arms dealers in Libya and the like. There's no secret about these things, about government ministers involved in apartment scandals. I've highlighted the situation many times about Irish apartment owners who bought property in Bulgaria, some of it as their home that they wanted to retire to. These were owner-occupied apartments, but the developer who built them has basically used his leverage in the management company to extort ever-increasing management fees from them, and he uses his control of the water and the electricity in order to extort that money, because if you can't, you know, go to the toilet or drink water, or if you don't have any heating in winter, well, then you can't stay in your apartment. And what he does is essentially, if people don't pay whatever he demands and it's completely unrelated to any expenditure, well, then he'll cut off your electricity and your water. Even though if you don't live in a unit for more than 30 days in a year, you don't legally have to pay anything. So they've gone to the courts, they've gone to the police. This has gone on for years, but it's indicative of the incestuous relationship between local authorities, between local political parties, mayors, judges and so on. And a lot of the more senior judiciary and a lot of the elements of the media, or some of them have been speaking out about this. But there's been, like, it's worse than the script of a sort of a Hollywood or a Bollywood B-movie. Like, you just Google some of these people and look at them, you know. You have the Prime Minister, Boyko Borisov, and then you have the Prosecutor General, Ivan Geshev. Now, Geshev was actually invited into the European Parliament last year to talk about corruption. This man was given the job in the face of massive protests. There's been undisputed evidence of the Prime Minister, Borisov, discussing with him about who should be prosecuted and who shouldn't be prosecuted. People have lost their businesses because they're on the wrong side of politics, or they haven't been prepared to pay the money. And in foot of all of this corruption that's been going on for years and well known, and as I said, the poorest country in the EU has sat back. They have this verification mechanism. Bulgaria and Romania are in this sort of B club where they need to show they're being good boys and girls before they're allowed to be full members of the EU. That's a bit suspect, that whole arrangement. But on the other side, civil society and the people of Bulgaria want the European Union using that to put manners on their own rotten establishment. But instead of that, EU money and EU influence has emboldened these people, because Borisov is very, very well connected with Merkel, with Ursula von der Leyen and with the EPP group in the European Parliament. That's where his people sit. They're ruthless people. Like, there's been stuff in the media recently. There was a big leak about Borisov, in pictures of him in the media in bed with a gun beside his pillow and drawers stuffed with 500 euro notes and bullion bars. Now, he said, yeah, he does sleep with the gun. Why wouldn't he in a country like that? But that the money and that was photoshopped into it. But, like, this is the type of mad stuff that's going on there. The people have risen up. There's been mass arrests, pepper sprayed, police sort of incitement with sort of ultras going into the crowd of protesters, throwing stones at the police, running away, and then the police attacking citizens, citizens being arrested, not being able to access. And the irony of the European Parliament screaming and roaring about Belarus, the people want elections, they want Borisov gone and they want Geshev gone. And, you know, they're all whinging in here about Belarus that people want Lukashenko gone, fair enough. But the European Union member Bulgaria, and they don't say anything. Commissioner Jourova was in, and the Bulgarian people, we've been inundated all week with protesters, a huge demonstration in Sofia while our meeting was going on. I believe I made the news there and got a lot of very good feedback from citizens in Bulgaria saying it's delighted that there's people in Europe speaking out for us because we're in the hands of these mobsters. And, you know, the point I was making is that they are being emboldened by the EU, but the EU ignoring them, not dealing with it. He's been clever not to attack minorities, and now he's getting away with this corruption and nobody says anything about them, and they're being facilitated by EU money, which has just been absolutely raped and pillaged by these.
They're net recipients as well, and these two countries, Romania and Bulgaria, be getting a lot of money from the EU compared to what they're giving.
There's huge studies, like irrefutable evidence of how the money has gone into the same big political elites, how it's mismanaged, looking after the relations, all the rest. You couldn't make it up. Like if it was in a film, you'd go, "Oh, this is a bit too tacky."
And but it is in the EU's interest, it seems, to kind of look over those things and not really pay much attention, because they want these two countries to be good examples of the Balkans and the and that region as well, so that we can kind of expand also in that region. But it's interesting that we just don't hear anything about this. I didn't hear anything about this till my friend from Bulgaria was talking to me about it. And as you say, like, we're hearing nonstop about Belarus.
Well, what's brilliant is that the people of Bulgaria are off their knees now, and they're out in the streets in a COVID situation, which is brilliant, like, you know, and it is a first, and it shows how sick they are of the situation. But like, they don't want to go back with nothing. Like, the response to the government has been, "Oh, we're going to do this constitutional reform. We are dealing with this." And in fairness, the commission was sort of buying that rubbish a bit. Now, she was a bit rattled as well. So I'd say they're being put under huge pressure behind the scenes. The commissioner, they know this is nonsense, and they know it makes a mockery of this rule of law nonsense when there's flagrant violations of rule of law, intimidation of judges, of the media, all sorts of stuff. But Europe's biggest secret is Bulgaria. Of course, it hit the headlines in Ireland with the workers who had to leave the country to come as fruit pickers to Ireland, where many of them ended up as well.
Yeah, and as you know, Damien, I had to raise the issue of Belarus at the GUI group meeting yesterday because it's obviously going to come up at the plenary next week, and the GUI have to reach a position, decide see if they can find any sort of agreement between the different members as to what our position should be on Belarus. Now, you have people all across the European Union screaming for regime change in Belarus, new elections. Now, listen, Lukashenko, and I know we discussed this in last week's episode, and Lukashenko is no angel, and I'd actually like to see the people of Belarus get rid of him, but I'd like to see the Belarus people get rid of them, not the West or not Russia. It has to be something that has to come from the people themselves. And if there is Western interference or Russian interference, then it won't end well. The West wants to get its fingers in the pie. It wants to implement neoliberal policies in there. It wants to have a say in who's running the place. It's already done this in Ukraine, and Ukraine has developed into a basket case. There was an organised US coup in 2014 in Ukraine, and the result has been very bad, and there's not only trouble, and the place is pauperised. And we don't want the same to happen to Belarus. There's been 4 people killed and an awful lot of people put in prison in Belarus, and that's terrible. And Lukashenko hopefully will be held to account by his own people, and hopefully in time they'll get rid of him as well as they can. But the gall right now, in through the whole month of August, the Israelis bombed Palestine as if it didn't matter. They also dropped a lot of bombs in Syria. But they've been initiating power cuts in the last couple of weeks in Palestine, in the West Bank. And children have died because of the power cuts. Women have died trying to have having cesarean section while giving birth. And we're not remotely concerned about that. We're all concerned that, we really care about Belarus. Or do we? We really care about the people of Belarus? Oh, come off it. No one really believes that. We care about getting in there and doing business in there and making money, but we don't really care about the people of Belarus. But it's a handy one for them. They don't want to know about the fact that there was 21 people killed at the protests in Chile when the protests were there last year, because it was a right-wing government and they supported them. They don't care about the fact that there's been hundreds killed now in Bolivia by the new government, which actually were never elected, but it was a military coup, but it was supported by the EU as well. So they don't count. It doesn't matter. They're very, very selective about who they want to support. And it's very sickening to listen to them.
It seems that Belarus, though, is more than just a handy thing for them. It's an extremely strategic place for the EU to now exert some influence. And we saw that as well with the new trade commissioner that we're going to be getting. Ireland didn't hold on to the portfolio as they were,
surprise.
Were holding on and were trying to push it. But it's now Valdis Dombrovskis, who is the Latvian commissioner already. So that kind of shows you this kind of push towards that kind of region as well, and trying to show like Europe is here for you, whatever. They're really trying to do work at all kind of avenues to try and see what they can do with Belarus, because it's, imagine like lying between Russia and the EU, it's an extremely important area for them to try and get their fingers on. So when we're talking about electoral interference or just interest in the region, it's like the top rank there, I think. US
their concern is certainly
another reason, a region you're going to hear a lot more of, which we were discussing today as well as foreign affairs, is the Balkans. And it is a horror scene how the US and the EU are interfering in a negative manner in order to exploit the region of huge mineral wealth. And there's a number of countries in the Balkans trying to join the European Union. They've been jumping through hoops for years to try and get free movement visas around Europe. And they've literally almost had to give away the country in order to get these visa passes, right? But the wheels are coming off, and there's going to be serious trouble in the Balkans. And the subject we were discussing today was Kosovo. My God, what is going on in Kosovo, Albania, Serbia, Montenegro, at the moment, beggar's belief. But we'll deal with it more another day.
And we haven't even mentioned what's going on with Turkey and the Greeks, and the illegal drilling off the shores of Greece, and the instability there now with Cyprus and Greece, and it's getting things are hotting up in the Mediterranean. And
obviously, Turkey can do what they like because they're in NATO. It's an embarrassment for the EU at the moment. They'd love to slap them down. Turkey, Erdogan does what he likes. He's engaging in Libya. He's engaging in the Eastern Mediterranean. He's an eye on the Greeks and he's an eye on the Cypriots. He's involved in Syria. They're involved in Lebanon. They're involved in Armenia lately. Turkey, whether we like it or not, and they're actually, most of the people in the EU give out about them a lot, right? Now, and it should be said that Turkey are behaving very badly, but they're getting away with it because they're in NATO. And they also, Turkey are playing a very smart game. Erdogan, he's pretty clever, and he's using connections with Russia to actually keep the West in their place as well. He's buying arms from the Russians, he's buying arms from the Americans, he's buying arms from the EU, and he's making stuff himself. And they're heavily militarised, they have a huge army, and they're dreaming of the glory days of the Ottoman Empire. And they're looking to expand their influence. And they've actually turned the tide in Libya. They've taken sides against Haftar in Libya. So you have different countries in Europe on different sides in Libya. I mean, what an absolute nightmare is Libya since 2011. And in fact, one of the things that we discussed as well at Foreign Affairs this week was the Irini military navigation project, which is supposed to, it replaced Operation Sophia, and it's supposed to stop, it's supposed to implement the arms embargo on Libya. In other words, stopped arms going in by sea from Libya. But we actually found it this week. They actually don't stop any arms. They only monitor them and they report them to the UN. And they told us that it was in camera, so we better not give them the numbers, but they gave us the number of ships that they had stopped and took note of what they were carrying, but then let them on their way. But then, of course, that's all a bit mad, given that most of the arms are going in by air and land for both sides. So stopping them going in by sea, and not even stopping them, but just monitoring them. And I mean, it's just nonsense, right? It's the EU pretending to be doing something about a situation where they've washed their hands of a long time ago, and they've allowed Libya to become a basket case. There's a slave trade operating in Libya today. And as I pointed out on Twitter last week, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael and Labour in 2011 in Ireland supported the invasion of Libya. Mm. And there's hundreds of thousands have lost their lives over it. A whole country has been destroyed, and surrounding countries.
That's it.
It's shocking. I mean, they were one of the wealthiest countries in Africa, and per head of capita, their education system was unparalleled. We had a situation in the airport for years. There used to be Libyans coming over and doing training with in the airport aircraft maintenance and so on. There was always a big contingency of them then, but the country is just completely and utterly devastated. I went there actually for the 20th anniversary of the revolution, as it was called at the time, of Gaddafi coming to power. So that was in 1989, and I was involved in USI, which is the Union of Students in Ireland, and at that time, the Libyan authorities organised a conference for African and European students, and Sinn Féin had a lot of people in USI at the time, and some of us lefty types. So we decided, sure, we'd go along to that. And obviously Gaddafi had been given arms to the IRA and that at a certain stage. So they kind of liked him for that reason. So we went along. We were the only Europeans that went, but it was incredibly interesting. Good few Africans went, all right, but to be there in Tripoli was just an outstanding experience. When we got into the airport, like, they had the whole place decked out with big banners and everything. No democracy without people's committees everywhere, you know, slogans like that, very prevalent. At the time, Gaddafi was quite secular. He had, you know, women in his army, in his bodyguards. It was not long after the time when the US had bombed his compound, killed some of his family. So there was a kind of a rallying around that. But an incredibly interesting experience and place. And it's somewhere I'd love to go back to. It's beyond sickening to think about what state it must be in now, because it was a wonderful, wonderful place, you know.
In other news, Mick, I was reading on your Twitter, you were tweeting there about the climate law, European climate law. We chatted about this a bit before, but there was a big vote today. Do you want to tell us a bit about what?
Yeah, look, I mean, there's been a lot of obviously talking about the environment since we came out here in July 2019. We're out here 15 months now. And environment has been one of the big gigs here. It's threatening to be undermined a bit, I think, for a couple of reasons. Obviously, COVID is a factor. Some people would argue, or people who didn't want serious change around how we deal with the challenges of climate change anyway, are using COVID as an excuse. Oh, we don't really have the money now. We have different challenges, and we have to pay for this, and we have to pay for that. We'll deal with the climate problems another day. And obviously, a problem, the climate law is central to this. So there's a big argument. First of all, the Paris Agreement was looking for us to prevent temperatures rising by more than 1.5 degrees. And some people of a more right-wing view think that 2% would be tolerable. But the scientists and the experts say otherwise. And I know, Damien, you know an awful lot more about this than I do. But the vote today is about how much we reduce emissions between now and 2030, because this is absolutely crucial. Because the more we delay, the more we postpone, the bigger the challenge will be later on. And the truth is that the experts, the science is saying that unless we can reduce emissions by at least 65% between now and 2030, we're going to have a huge problem. And about this time last year, I noticed that there was probably a majority in the parliament. And if I was asked about it at the time, I would have argued that, you know what, when this goes to a vote, I can see the majority going for about 65%. Mm. But in actual fact, were back down to talk on 55 or 50. And I suppose what I was pointing out in my tweet was the fact that the negotiator for the biggest group in the parliament, the EPP, who are obviously the more right wing, one of the more right wing parties, they're looking at 50 or 55, not 60 or 65. And Mairead McGuinness, who's just been appointed to the job of commissioner, well, has been appointed to be to go forward towards it. Obviously, has to pass the parliament still, but it'll be expected that she will get it. And Mairead was a negotiator for the EPP on this issue. And unfortunately, from our point of view, Mairead hasn't had a progressive position on it. It's pretty conservative, pretty right-wing. And I was just highlighting the fact that really it would be so important if she could actually find it to just go to that different space. This is so important. People are saying that this is really decisive and it's a real game changer. And if we could go for 65% on this, it would be brilliant. And if we find ourselves at 50 or 55, I think the world will regret it and the planet will suffer.
Yeah, that's it. And so the vote happened today. We'll get the results tomorrow. And then after that, it'll go to the plenary session in October. So we'll have a debate and another vote there, at least in the vote in October. But we can have public votes so we can see how everyone's voting. But as you say, Mick, like it is a bit depressing to think that there's so little support for a 65% target, which is the bare minimum we need to keep under 1.5 degrees for 2030.
Well, I think Mick made a good point. I mean, he's definitely right, is that this issue has, like, it was top of the sexy issue to be involved in stakes when the elections were held last year. Load of Greens got elected. The environment was a key issue on a lot of, and that was brought into the sort of formation of the European Parliament. That has completely receded now. Post-COVID is a lot of it. It's on the back burner now in a way in which it wasn't before. And I suppose one of the messages for that, even though it's difficult now, is the level of protests and civil engagement around the issue was a key reason why the politicians were kept on their toes and in check. And it is a lesson, I suppose, that people and society needs to be organised in order to keep these issues on the agenda, because it's not going to be.
It's funny you mentioned that, because the so-called green wave last May that we had, we got two green MEPs elected in Ireland and neither of them have done anything on the climate law, no amendments, nothing. So I know they're doing work in the parliament, but it's interesting what they're engaging in. They're members as well of the Environment Committee, so it's interesting that that's, the engagement hasn't happened there. So, but the thing, the big question, as you say, is the 2030 target. Will we get 65? No, because we don't have the majority. Will we get 60? Very, very, very thin majority if that happens. Or will we get 55 or 50, which is really, really low. And it's far too low to be able to hold our heads up high and say the European Union is a leader on climate change. That would be farcical if that's the case.
So, I think while it was interesting talking about what we were doing this week, I mean, I think we need to spend some time on what we should have been doing or what we would have been doing if COVID hadn't happened. And that was being, we should have spent this week observing the trial of Julian Assange back in the Old Bailey now in London. And we'd made the point last week that obviously with COVID that wasn't going to happen, but that we were going to tune in, and we had been approved by the Ministry for Justice to watch it online, to have remote access via computer. So we spent the morning of Monday trying to tune into the proceedings, and then it emerged that the judge in the district court had decided that even though we'd been given approval and we were one or two of 40 politicians, NGOs, civil society groups who'd been authorised to access the proceedings remotely, the judge decided that no, that was a threat to the integrity of her court and that wasn't going to happen. That we could go and observe in the overspill room of the court if we wanted. Now, bear in mind that there is one overspill room which holds eight people. There's huge media interest in this case. We had travelled to the UK in February and had observed the proceedings. The judge made the point that during the last proceedings that somebody took a picture of Julian and put it on social media. But, you know, what's that got to do with remote proceedings? That was when they were in the court, you know. But she was saying, I need to control my courtroom. But that's incredibly derogatory, if you like. I mean, as we said, we deal with classified information. We go to in-camera meetings as part of our job. The idea that we couldn't be trusted to observe court rules is absolutely ludicrous. The whole point is, if justice is seen to be done, it must be done in public. And I have to say, the signs from the UK court are really worrying. Because after that, after she decided that we couldn't observe it remotely, which was bad enough, the defence then went on to make the point, I think we mentioned it before, the Americans came in late in the summer after the defence points, technical points, had closed in February. They came in with a second superseding indictment to do, if you like, a secondary extradition process after the original one had been heard. If you like, a ladybird version of that would be that they weren't sure that they'd get him on all of the things they outlined in the first one. So they brought in a whole new batch of stuff after the closing date had happened. Now, the defence made the point to the judge that this was completely unacceptable, unprecedented, actually. And, you know, they made the point that it was abnormal, unfair and liable to cause a real injustice. And they wanted that struck down and not entertained at all. The judge was saying, well, you know, if you hadn't got enough time, you could always have asked to put it off, adjourn it. They made the point that you're dealing with a very sick man whose health has been seriously jeopardised in very unsanitary conditions in Belmarsh Prison. They don't want anything to prolong the proceedings, so they didn't want to prolong it. They wanted to go ahead. But when she said she wouldn't strike out the second superseding indictment and extradition, they said, OK, we'll have an adjournment. And she said, no, you're not getting one. There won't be an adjournment now, which was absolutely unbelievable. She said, you should have taken proceeding. But as the defence said, like when that all of that documentation came from America, introducing a whole rake of other charges, Julian Assange was in Belmarsh. He had limited access to his lawyers during the lockdown. He actually had to talk to them on a payphone in the corridor when the documents, the legal documents, he hadn't even seen them. And the judge wanted him to instruct his legal team in those circumstances in a trial where he faces espionage and a possible penalty of 175 years in prison. I mean, you couldn't make it up. Anyway, the case proceeded. Other witnesses for the defence were then heard. She also said, by the way, that she wasn't going to allow defence witnesses any more than 30 minutes. She had their statements. She wasn't going to be listening to them going through the statements. 30 minutes, that was it. And then they were there to be cross-examined on their evidence and that then the prosecution could ask them questions. Well, seemingly, from the prosecution's point of view, that didn't go too well the first day because the defence witnesses were absolutely excellent. They stood their ground. They showed the political nature of this charge. And then, I suppose, to cut a long story short, the proceedings then had to adjourn the next day because... Boohoo, one of the American legal team has corona-like symptoms and the case has to be postponed until they know what to do. So, I mean, it's funny and it's not funny because the longer this goes on, the longer Julian is in Belmarsh. As I said, his health is very poorly. It's likely anyway, no matter what happens in this proceeding, that it's going to be appealed to one or two higher courts and then possibly go to the European. This man who's already spent years effectively incarcerated is looking to spend way, way more. And it's just completely and utterly appalling. As we made the point, it's the biggest press freedom case of a generation. It's incredibly important. We mentioned last week that we had some paraphernalia, tote bags and notebooks and pens and stuff with Julian's quote, like, if wars can be started by lies, peace can be started by the truth. And we told people last week when you weren't here, Damien, we were generous. We said if anybody wanted some of that stuff, we'd send it out to them. And we were very pleasantly surprised by a whole number of people who contacted us via Twitter and via email asking for the stuff, and we've sent it out to them, and we hope that they proudly wear those messages in solidarity with Julian and tune in to Bridges for Media Freedom. We'll be following this case, you know.
Great. Well, that's it. There you have it, your 23rd episode of IFRC Trouble. Thanks for listening, and you can get us on Twitter at IFRC Trouble. Let us know what you think and share the podcast and like it and do everything that you can to spread the word. Thanks very much, and we'll see you next time.
Ciao, ciao.